Today's episode of the Film Stage Roundtable is brought to you by Mubi, the streaming online cinema. For your free trial, go to mubi.com/filmstage.
Try to see it my way. Do I have to keep on talking till I can go on? While you see it your way, run the risk of knowing that our love may soon be gone. We can work it out. We can work it out.
Think Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to a brand new episode of the Film Stage Roundtable. This, of course, is the spin-off of the Film Stage show. During these episodes, rather than reviewing a movie, we actually talk about content related to film culture as a whole. So if you have any burning, crazy questions you want to ask us, make sure to hit us up on Twitter and Facebook, and we'll be more than happy to talk those through with you. And who are we? Let's see. Today we have Michael Snydell.
Hello, good evening.
Good evening. We also have Bill Graham.
Woo!
And as a special treat, we also have Dan Mecca.
Howdy.
Dan Mecca, who is my nemesis, now that Nick Newman isn't on these things that often.
That is correct.
Yes. You may remember Dan Mecca from our Batman v Superman podcast and the contentiousness therein. Anyway, God, let's...
Happy to be here.
I bet you fucking are, you monster. All right, well, let's get into all the stuff, and then we can talk about the things that we're here to talk about. So, social media, you can find us. My daughter is freaking out already.
Does she have a Twitter page yet?
A true millennial, every time she hears social media, she's just like, what? Oh my God, I'm on that. No, I don't think we've named her generation yet, so I'll be excited to learn what I get to complain about that my daughter is a part of. Anyway, social media. You can find us on Twitter at Film Stage Show. You can also catch us on Facebook searching for The Film Stage Show. And if you really want to lay into us, you can email us at podcast@thefilmstage.com. And, yeah, that's about it. That's all you need. Let me remind everyone that we are sponsored by Mubi, the streaming online cinema. Unlike other such online services, Mubi's selection is actually curated, which means they give a damn about what they are putting in front of your eyeballs. Every day they release a new film, and you have 30 days to feast your eyes upon it, after which it disappears into the ether. That means they always have 30 great films for you to enjoy by streaming or, as I love to point out, by downloading before you go so that you don't have to worry about a spotty internet connection messing up your viewing experience on the road.
Mubi. Yep, I only have to worry about how much data you have on your phone.
I mean, I'm assuming you'd be downloading via Wi-Fi.
No, I'm saying like actual space.
Oh, okay. That would be storage.
Well,
anyway,
it's still data.
Semantics aside, yes, that is Mubi. Go to mubi.com/filmstage and you can get a free month trial of Mubi on us because we love you just as much as Mubi loves us.
Get on those stray cats.
Stray cat rock. All right, down to brass tacks. Today we have two fantabulous topics to talk about. The first came from Facebook, and the second came from Dan Mecca, which is why he is here. So let's do the one from the fan first, because...
Can I tell you, I'm kind of more excited to talk about the first thing, actually, at this point, so it's good. So it's a good thing. It's
well,
a lot of positive,
I'm
a lot of positive
that.
Energy. You know?
I'm glad to hear that you're underwhelmed by your own topic choice, which we are going to have to do later.
Yeah, I didn't say that, Brian.
Oh, God. All right. Let's do this. Our first topic, Twice as Nice or Double Trouble?
Love me two times, baby. Love
found me twice today. I'm a two-time girl.
All right. That is Love Me Two Times by The Doors. And that's because it is thematically relevant to what we are about to talk about. On Facebook, Alex Childs, I believe is how that is that last name is pronounced, asked the following question. Does needing to rewatch a movie for a second or third time to appreciate it tell you something about its complexity, quality, or is it more of a flaw? Don't require any more prattling on from me beyond that. It is a simple question with many, many facets, so let's hop right into discussing it. Dan Mecca, you're a guest. You said you were excited about this. So why don't you kick us off? You see a movie. Someone tells you, hey man, you got to see this thing twice to really appreciate it. Does that tell you interesting, complex, thematically rich movie, or incoherent piece of shit that I need a second chance to try to understand?
Well, I think it can be both to some degree. I mean, I think that there are plenty of examples of movies where you can see it once and maybe not fully appreciate what you're watching, and then watch it a second time, you know, down the road, or, you know, even, you know, a week after, whatever, whenever you rewatch it, and kind of appreciate things you never saw before. I think a big part of this question is kind of, it's as much about the movies as it is about when you're watching the movies, and you know, kind of what your palate is when you watch it. So, I mean, I think it can be both. I mean, I think that there are movies, like, for example, when I was thinking about this question, Heaven's Gate is a movie that I love right now. I love it now because I appreciate all of the flaws along with all of the ambition that went into making that movie. So it's way too long and overreaching, and kind of at times you almost, you know, like can't understand what's happening or hear necessarily what characters are saying to some degree. Right. So that's a mess. I mean, that will be a mess, you know, forever. It's not like that movie will not be what it is in that scenario. That being said, I love it and consider it to be some sort of a masterpiece for all of those flaws and ambition that went into it now. Whereas when I watched it, you know, I don't know, 10 years ago, I didn't think that at all. So that's one side of it. And then the other side is, you know, a movie like, for me, Eyes Wide Shut, which when I watched in, you know, I don't know, the early 2000s, I was a young teenager and I was on some channel, and I probably watched it for reasons that were far more shallow than they should, you know, like that were appropriate for a 14-year-old, you know, and I'd heard, you know, the narrative for that movie back then, if anybody remembers, was pretty negative. I mean, it was considered a flop.
Yeah.
People had basically, there was this kind of a rumor that I believe Arlie Ermey actually perpetrated, which basically said that Kubrick had gotten his movie stolen from him by Cruise and Kidman in the editing room, like while he was dying, which I believe has kind of been, you know, debunked. But so basically all that went into this basically underwhelming summer movie that came out. And so all of those things I considered when I watched this movie when I was however old I was. And I hated it. I hated it. I was bored by it. I thought it was, you know, meandering and like a vanity project. You know, I don't even know if I knew what vanity project meant back then, but that's what it felt like. Just kind of like Cruise and Kidman, like fucking around for 2.5 hours. And I didn't really understand what that meant. And now it's literally my favorite movie. It is my personal favorite movie. So, you know, I've watched it probably 30 times, and every single time I garner something new from it and the complexities of every single shot. And I've read myriad essays on what everything means and, you know, kind of dipped into the, you know, the novella that it's based on. And I hope it's a novella, you know, the short piece of work that it's based on and, you know, all that stuff. So that is a prime example of a movie that not only seeing it twice adds more layers, but seeing it 20 times adds more layers in my opinion to it. And that's, you know, I think Kubrick and PTA and Tarkovsky and these guys, they're all prime examples of filmmakers who probably, they have so much going on in their heads when they're making films. It's really, and it's not surprising that it would take more than one viewing to really appreciate it. So
now, I guess I have a question. How soon was it between seeing it the first time
and the
second time?
Years.
So, I mean, more like growth on your part than the movie just...
Probably both. Probably both. You know, I mean, like, well, the Heaven's Gate, same thing. I saw it, you know, I caught it, you know, at a relatively young age, you know, high school. And, you know, I didn't know a whole lot about it. I think I just watched Deer Hunter probably. You know what I mean? It was one of those. And, like, I didn't like it. And, look, I truly believe that whether or not you're going to admit it, you know, the pejorative view, right? Like, you are affected by the things you read and hear. So, I mean, yeah, I think I probably revisited Eyes Wide Shut because I read an article by somebody I respected that said, hey, this is a misunderstood film. And I rewatched it probably in that context and really saw something there that spoke to me and then watched it 19 more times. You know what I mean? So it's, I think these are, you know, I think it can be any movie. I mean, I rewatched Billy Madison with my now wife recently. Okay. And we were under the influence, right? And that movie is, under the right circumstances, one of the funniest, still, right, 28 years old, one of the funniest movies I've ever seen. Right. It's not a good, is it a good movie? No, but I mean, that's one that I've always liked, but has aged surprisingly well, you know, over the years. But, you know, so that's kind of my take on all that. So,
all right.
Well, it's interesting you mentioned I just want to bring up something real quick. I mean, it's interesting you mentioned Eyes Wide Shut, and you also mentioned Heaven's Gate, which are, you know, you were talking a little bit about the influence that comes from reading about things. But those are movies that, especially in, I don't know whether it's just in recent years, I'm a little younger than all you guys, but I was kind of prepared for movies in that vein, you know, being told that they're very challenging. Like, I think one movie that one of our commenters mentioned was last year at Marienbad, which I caught for the first time last year. And I definitely had an experience where I said, you know what, I know this is something special, but it's beyond my grasp on this first concrete viewing. And the experience I wanted to talk about specifically with that is Shane Carruth's films, which are Primer and Upstream Color. And I mean, they get lumped together, but they're they operate in two very different ways, in the sense of Primer's a very technical is the word that's used often to describe it, just because there's like such a strong sense of mechanisms to its rules and things along those lines.
Sure, it's a crazy movie that feels smart, right? And it challenges you the entire way, even though you've seen kind of time travel movies that you can tell when they start talking about or they start getting into the time travel aspects, you're just like, oh, this is a dumb movie, but it's hard to follow. Whereas sure. Primer feels like it's, and maybe that's a pretentious feeling, or maybe it's something that you latch onto, but for sure it feels smart, right?
It feels like a scientific method.
Yeah.
Embedded in it. I guess Primer isn't really the one I want to talk about as much as Upstream Color though, which was confusing because it's, you know, so fundamentally abstract. And actually, embarrassingly, in college, I wrote about Upstream Color and called it a sham because I thought I was being provocative.
You just provoked me, you asshole.
I think the word now is triggered. You triggered me.
Okay. I went back to it about a year later. It didn't help that my friend who I was with, who I will not shame on a podcast, but she fell asleep during a double feature of Primer and Upstream Color.
Oh, geez.
We were at, and she was snoring. It was pretty funny. She's a wonderful human being, but not one of her finest movie-going moments. I guess the thing about Upstream Color is that was something that it took me until the second time where I could really just fully sink into the sensory experience. Because I think it was especially strange after watching something like Primer, which, Bill, you've already described how intricate it feels. And then you go to something like Upstream Color, which doesn't have that, which has a strong narrative foundation, but it's much more textural and sensory than something mechanical.
Sure. I can see someone that doesn't necessarily appreciate art or maybe cinema really liking Primer and just being completely confused and lost by Upstream Color, right?
Because yeah.
There's
left brain, right brain.
Yeah, there's definitely two sides of that.
Well, Bill, is there any film that you had to see twice, or is someone going to argue that this is a bullshit argument?
No, I don't think this is a bullshit argument. I'm going to bring up a couple of things because I know Michael and I both agreed on this. I don't really rewatch a lot of movies. In fact, I don't buy a lot of movies. I'm lucky enough now where I get sent a lot of kind of Oscar season screeners and things like that. And, you know, those are films that maybe I wouldn't necessarily buy, but now that I have access to them again, I'll kind of, you know, put on to kind of put in the background here and there, things like that. But so I'm just not a big rewatcher. Now, that doesn't mean that I haven't gone through and seen Aliens or, you know, Jaws or some of these other classic films again and again and again, simply because they're on TV often or things like that. But I'll say this. So when we talk about rewatching, I'm going to put something different in here. And I'm going to say rewatching for me a lot of times ends up being either listening to podcasts that really kind of dive deep into that film, reading reviews or articles, things like that. So, or even talking to some of my friends or doing things like this, like doing a podcast. I think that's kind of the way that I re-experience a lot of films, and I really appreciate the way that hearing about them, talking about them, reading about them can kind of recontextualize them, you know, kind of smooth over points that I didn't quite understand or wasn't quite grasping, or even give a kind of a different experience on. So you know, that's happened. There's some great podcasts out there that people are just going bananas for right now, where like they're taking every minute and they're spending like an entire podcast on it. I think
isn't there an Aliens one?
Yeah, they're doing one for Aliens, and they say that like I was listening to someone talk about being like going to be on that podcast, and they were talking about which minute they had, and they said that it was a blast kind of watching that 1 minute in a loop over and over and over because there was so much to unpack, and that blows my mind. But it also gives us a chance to kind of look at the minute details of some of these bigger films that people have seen so many times that it's very easy to watch it again in kind of like a glazed over look, right? And so these podcasts kind of give a chance to kind of rewatch that with fresh eyes, right?
But that's I would say that's more of like rewatching for appreciation of a thing that you already liked. You know?
It can happen that way, and I agree, but what I'm saying is though, like those specific podcasts, obviously nobody would listen to the Aliens podcast if they didn't like the Aliens movie, because can you imagine having every single minute like described to you for 30 minutes? That would
if you
be
hated
excruciating.
That movie and you're just like, this might help me like it more.
Yeah.
Let me listen to a podcast that's 120 episodes.
Yeah, but like what I'm saying is, for me, even films that I didn't like, I'll listen to a podcast or maybe read a review or something like that.
Sure.
And that will give me kind of the ability to kind of, and maybe I won't, like I said, rewatch it, but just listening to a really in-depth and detailed podcast about it will kind of help sometimes. It'll make the film either better, or sometimes it'll just reinforce what I hated about it, right? But for me, the big film that happened where I had to watch it a second time was The Big Lebowski. And I know the Coen brothers films, a lot of them were mentioned. Some people just blanket mentioned Coen brother films, along with Paul Thomas Anderson, and I definitely get PTA at times. But for me, The Big Lebowski was a struggle to watch it the first time because I had known it was supposed to be one of the, you know, greatest comedies of all time. Some people feel it's one of the best movies of all time, things like that, right? And so when I watched it, I had kind of a lot of hype going in, and I made the classic mistake of watching a comedy alone by myself without, you know, any kind of context or anything like that. And so when I watched it, the humor is very dry in the film. Without someone to kind of bounce off of, it's hard to kind of get into it, at least for me. And it took a second watch. And actually, the second watch was by myself again. And that second time, I knew kind of the rough beats of the plot, and I was able to kind of follow and really engross myself in what was actually happening and kind of the way that they kept swerving around obvious kind of pitfalls and things like that that would, you know, completely mess up the plot or things like that. I'm talking about in the characters' kind of world and things like that, because I mean ultimately The Big Lebowski is just a big misunderstanding movie, right? And so the characters just kind of go throughout the entire film not understanding what is going on and why certain things are happening. And it all kind of stems from one kind of confusing moment. And so that was definitely a film for me. Upstream Color, for sure.
Bill, I'm curious, was that second experience with other people?
For what?
Big Lebowski.
No. So The Big Lebowski, the second experience, was by myself again.
Okay, it was.
Curious enough. But like I said, I was able to just kind of understand what was going on with the plot details. And so that wasn't kind of stringing me along. I was able to pay attention to what was actually happening with the character beats and things like that. And then, again, it happened to me with Upstream Color. Although I didn't actually I watched it a second time, but that was much later. The first time I watched it, I was able to appreciate it by literally sharing a couple of beers with some friends afterwards and just talking through it. But, you know, even talking about like the podcast and things like that, The Witch, when we did the podcast on The Witch, I didn't realize quite how many things were raveled into that film. I came away from it kind of a little bit mixed, and after doing the podcast for it, talking about it for an hour, you know, I ended up being pretty high on it. So
I guess for me, I've never had my opinion on a movie changed by a second viewing. I've never like I saw Last Year at Marienbad as a freshman, I think, in college, and while I didn't get it, I loved it. And that love made me go back and see it again. And then I ended up seeing it like 12 times that semester because I ended up writing my term paper on it. Now, that's a completely different thing than seeing a movie, hating it, and then having someone say, oh, you need to see it twice to really appreciate it. And I think that somehow, instinctually, you'll know if you feel like a movie is something that you want a deeper understanding of, either out of a pre-existing love or an understanding of what it was trying to do, but an uncertainty as to whether or not it worked, or whether or not you just didn't like something. For instance, I saw Monty Python and the Holy Grail as a child. I was in the Boy Scouts, so I was still in high school, at least. And no, I was in middle school, I think. So I saw this movie that I'd heard people talk about before, and I didn't laugh once. But then in the car talking with my father coming home from this Boy Scout camp. He was super excited and started batting lines at me for me to hit him back with the next line. And it became funny. Now that's, I don't think, something that would fall under that. I don't know if watching the movie again would have helped me. I think, because I was so young, having someone who maybe grasped British comedy better than I did, there to kind of usher me through this, helped out. But, like, I'll never watch another Alex Ross Perry film twice. Like, that's just not going to happen. Because on an instinctual level, there is nothing more that I could dredge from those fucking films that would possibly make me like them more. And if someone said, oh, listen up, Philip, man, you know, the second time it really opens up, I would punch them in the mouth and then leave that party.
But that brings up an interesting, what you're saying is interesting, right? Because I think that cultural thing, when you're talking about the subject, is kind of important because, you know, you saw Holy Grail and you were in the car with your father who understood it to some degree or appreciated it to some degree that you couldn't fully appreciate, but his appreciation made you kind of consider or reconsider what you had seen to some degree, right? I remember seeing Anchorman in 2008. I was in high school.
Okay.
In high school? '04, when Anchorman came out. I was in high school, and I did not like it. I saw it with a group of friends, and I was just kind of like, eh, you know? But I remember in those months, weeks after the movie came out, people were like spatting around the lines and having fun with how the absurdity and da-da-da. And, you know, cut to now or a year after that or a month after that, and we all loved it, and we watch it now and we love it, and it's funny, and it's screens all the time and it plays all the time. So I bet if you did watch Holy Grail now or, you know, whenever, you would laugh because...
But I think that's more, again, we're talking about like more like growth. Like, I think...
Yeah, but wouldn't Holy you, Grail but wouldn't you my... say that is... But there is growth. There is growth there. There is cultural growth. I think it's important to remember that movies... are more than just their art form.
I want to stick to the real, like, wording of the question, because it's like, oh, what's a movie that you saw as a child and didn't like? Because in that case, I could probably say, oh, I don't know, something that I saw way too early, but then went back to. I can't think of any off the top of my head, but, like, this is like, you know how people went and saw, and this movie came up a lot, Inherent Vice, and a lot of people were like, deeply underwhelmed, and then that was a movie
or angry
but that was a movie where people keep saying go back and see it again and you'll like it, like as though if you were to turn around as you were walking out and just stay in the theater it would open up for you. Like I think we should talk about like immediate revisiting of the text. And then, like, is that something that you think is possible to do a 180 if you were to, like, instantaneously watch the film again? Like, taking character development and growth of your own self out.
Well, like, the weird thing that we haven't distinguished here, too, is, you know, there's some films that have, like, an aesthetic craft that you didn't recognize. So you take, like, something like Once Upon a Time in America or Lawrence of Arabia, right. And there's so much going on in those films. But then there's also things like Inherent Vice, or I'd say quite a bit of noir that like narratively is very difficult to untangle.
Right.
But then you also run into the weird thing about your choice, Brent, like Monty Python, is that there's some people who Monty Python, it's not a problem of not being able to appreciate it. Some people who just do not vibe with British humor in the same way some people don't vibe with the Marx Brothers or, you know, Laurel and Hardy or, you know, any
Three Stooges.
Stooges. Exactly. And
yeah.
Humor is comedy. Super subjective.
Sure.
Now, so like, as to what you were. Oh, I'm sorry. Go on.
No, I'm saying it's just more complicated. I'm just realizing it's way more complicated, and that doesn't really help our question. But no. There's a lot of different branching paths.
I mean, you brought up aesthetically a bunch of movies that are great, and that without realizing the technical craft behind what makes them great, you could still feel them being great. Like, I think that when we talk about going back on a film and watching it one minute at a time, or learning about whatever, the cinematography or the camera tricks that really go in to making them great. We're not talking about gaining new knowledge. We're talking about like unearthing the things that subconsciously were already working on you. But like, no matter what twist a movie has, I've never like felt like if I turned around and went right back, I would feel markedly different about it.
Well, let's be honest. Like, let's steer away from the way that you're kind of phrasing that question, because
I think
the question is, would a second viewing mean? Or would a required second viewing basically mean that a film is bullshit, or if it's just that complex? What you're suggesting is watching it twice back to back, which for most people, they would, if they didn't like the film to begin with, they would just want to blow their head. Yeah, they would just be like, what is, like, why am I doing this? This is really dumb, right? I think it helps because if someone goes in understanding, right, there's two different kinds of films, right? There's a film where you go in understanding it's going to be complex, so you maybe turn your brain on already. And then there's a film that maybe you walk out of and you're like, what the hell was that? You weren't prepared for it. And then someone tells you, no, it's much more complex. You got to watch it and maybe think of it in this term. And then you go watch it, and what that sounds like, though, is for you, Brian, that's cheating, because it's getting some of the culture, it's getting some of the already unpacked response to that film,
but shouldn't
and
film,
giving it to you.
Shouldn't the film present itself in a way where you see it the way it wants to be seen?
I don't think that's always the case. I don't think, because I think there are films out there that contextually make a lot more sense about what is going on. One of those movies was Holy Motors a couple of years ago, and the director was going through, I believe his wife had recently passed away from cancer or something along those lines, and a lot of people were saying, oh, did you watch that film and not know that? Or did you watch that film knowing that this director had gone through this traumatic experience, and that was what the film was kind of about? Because for me, watching that film was just a madhouse. I had no idea what was going on. I couldn't tell narratively what was the through line, except that it was a very dark and kind of demented view of kind of a futuristic or slightly futuristic world. And I just couldn't really unpack it. And once it was given to me in those terms, it helped me contextualize what was going on in that film. Now, I think in a way, that's exactly what this guy is asking, right? He's saying, if someone tells you that you kind of rewatch it under a certain idea, that maybe that film requires,
is it that film's that, problem then?
Well, yeah, I mean, maybe that film requires wording, that context.
The guy's wording never brought up introducing new context and then going to see the film again. It
sure,
just said
but,
rewatching
but he,
the film. But at was, the same time,
but by virtue of asking about whether it's bullshit or not, then you are.
Wait, so can I? Yeah, let me interject real quick.
Yeah,
so
sorry.
I Go think ahead, Brian, what you're talking about, right? I think I've been thinking about this while y'all have been talking, and now I'm saying y'all because Bill says y'all, and then I say y'all.
I say y'all too.
So while you all have been talking,
guys,
it seems like to what Brian is talking about, which I just think generally is less interesting, right? Because I think culturally, obviously, that rewatching of things is super interesting, right? When there is like kind of a cultural aspect involved. But okay, negating that and talking about, you see a movie, and then the minute after, you're like, oh man, I wonder if I watch that again in the next 24 hours, would that add to the discussion? I think a perfect example of that is Memento, right? Because you watch Memento, okay, and you're like, anybody watching it, if you don't know anything about it or not, you don't know a lot about it from the first viewing, you're a bit confused perhaps, but you're
on board,
intrigued, you're on board, what happened. if you watch it that next time, not too long after, you're that connection of, oh, I see what was happening this whole time. And, you know, I guess that assumes you didn't see it all the first time, but let's just assume that that mm-hmm. is the case. That's probably an amazing second viewing, right? I mean, that's probably, you know, so I think that is your answer in the example of Memento. Yes, there can be movies. But here's, I guess, the more interesting kind of follow-up to that is, right, and just to kind of bring it all home within the same auteur, is Inception. Now, when I saw Inception, I still like it very much. It's a very good piece of entertainment. The first time I saw it, I was blown away, right? I feel like many were. Mm-hmm. It's an amazingly structured movie, an amazingly edited film. Okay. Now, I've seen it, I don't know, three times, four times since. You know, it's on TV a lot. That movie, in my opinion, okay, depreciates once you have watched it, engaged with it, know what's going to happen. And then when you know all these things and you rewatch it, all of the holes and the kind of the laborious moments and over exposition and all of this, mm-hmm. they stand out, right? Now, and I'm not saying this is necessarily a flaw, right? Like, that is a movie that is built for the cinema, the big screen, and it works on every level. Yeah. But it becomes porous, right, in my opinion, not unlike Dark Knight Rises, upon multiple viewings. And Memento, maybe in that same way, on the fourth viewing, does the same thing. I don't really fully know. So I just think it's interesting. I think the answer is definitely yes. You know, it doesn't have to be every movie, but Memento is just a good example of how in an immediate rewatch, it would be, you know, really nice. And then maybe, or even The Prestige, I guess, you know, to some degree, yeah. you know, so he's a good filmmaker perhaps to kind of discuss it under. But yeah, that would be my kind of takeaway from that.
Right. Because in those cases, but I guess I'm not quite devil's advocating here because I honestly believe what I'm saying. I still think that you're going to know on a deep subconscious level whether or not the film worked for you, and that an appreciation that wasn't already there won't develop on the second viewing. And I feel like, Bill, you make a point about Holy Motors. I mean, a lot of films, like, I thought Bram Stoker's Dracula by Francis Ford Coppola was nonsense. And then I realized that all the effects were done in camera. That's cool, but if I had never learned that, if I saw this film in an artistic vacuum without any concept of what the artist had to do to make it, it wouldn't matter, you know, because I wouldn't know that. So I feel like if a movie can't bring in that context and make it inherent and readily noticeable from the outset, that might be a failing of the film. Now, you can obviously correct that failing by learning about it, but I think that the idea of extratextual content helping in some way is at once not 100% part of this argument and also not a particularly good argument even for that. Does that make sense?
Well, yeah, I think obviously if a film needs contextualizing for you to understand and appreciate it, that's either a failing on you or that's a failing on the film. And most people are going to view that as a failing on the film, right? Mm-hmm. They're just going to be, well, I shouldn't have to know that shit.
Right.
The film should just give it to me, right?
I feel like there are also examples where, you know, you're dealing with avant-garde filmmakers. Like, the obvious one is Godard, where it's someone where if you don't have some familiarity with his other films, you're not probably going to get the same appreciation. I mean, there's certain filmmakers who are particularly conditioning people to try to understand their films in relation to, you know, their other work. So I guess what I'm trying to say there is that it's so – there are some films that aren't providing that context, but they're requiring as much work from you.
Right. And I guess that's going to have to be a whole other discussion, is extra textual information in films and an auteur teaching you to watch their own work. Should art be able to stand in a vacuum, or is it allowable to bring in extra examples and evidence in order to make a case for it? But unfortunately, we don't have time for that, which sucks. I do think that in general we've agreed that there is something to be said for the argument of rewatching a movie a second or third time to appreciate it is a real thing, but on different levels.
Sure.
Yes. Okay. Definitely. Well, now we get to hear from... Now, it's funny because I asked this question on Twitter, and the question was, what's something you either had to see twice to get it, or do you think this argument is bullshit? And no one said this argument was bullshit.
Anybody have a devil's advocate argument about that?
I think I came as close as you can to making one, in that if you're going to like it, you're going to like it, and it'll reveal more of its reasons for why you like it on a second viewing, but you'll already have appreciated it. Like, I don't think you're gonna come to Jesus on a second viewing. You know what I mean?
Sure.
Cora obviously agrees with me because she's cooing like crazy. But anyway.
I guess.
To the listener comments. I'm just going to say that the first one from David Jaffe says, Cloud Atlas demands to be seen more than once. I don't know if you listen to this program, David. I firmly disagree with you, but that's fine because this is your time to shine. So,
is this the Rock and Robin time?
Yeah, we're gonna click the Rock and Robin now. Bill, you know how much I hate Cloud Atlas.
Okay,
you know. I think Amanda really disagreed
with you on this one.
What was that?
Didn't John Fink really disagree with you on this one?
I think a lot.
You got mad at him.
Disagree with me. I'm pretty sure that Amanda Waltz agreed with me firmly, though. That was one of the few things that we were able to connect positively on. But anyway, let's get ready for the Rock and Robin. I don't know how many Rock and Robins this is going to take, but all right, let's find out. Okay, as I said, David Jaffe, Cloud Atlas demands to be seen more than once. Andrew Graber said Schenectady, New York, and like back to back. First Time Watchers, which is an ironic name, says Drive. Harry said Inherent Vice for sure. My opinion took a near 180 degree for the better after seeing it a few weeks after the first viewing. John Woo said The Prestige. Mike Mazanti, who I can never get right, said for me, The Counselor. Anna Swanson said,
fuck that movie.
I love that movie, Bill. Under the Skin, says Anna Swanson. Also agree with the people who said Drive and Inherent Vice. The Popcorn Muncher. Any film that hinges on a twist should probably be viewed twice. Usual Suspects, for example, does not hold up, which is not something that we talked about. Pitt says Enemy, Inception, Upstream Color. Zod's Snapped Neck says Interstellar. It's so dense and emotional that taking it in all the first time makes it difficult to process and fully appreciate. John Nix said Upstream Color and The Informant. Hated both on first watch, reduced to tears on the second. Paul Aguilera, almost anything from PTA, Film Goon, said Into the Wild. Rahul Adesimili said Down by Law. Jordan Raup, our benevolent Lord and Master, says, I feel like there's two categories for this. One, comedies that are funnier on repetition. Step Brothers, Hot Rod, anything by David Wayne. Two, films that wash over you and reveal new details each time. Malick, PTA, especially Inherent Vice. Tarkovsky, etc. Oleg Nikishinkin, David Lynch movies, but twice is not enough. Three, four, five, six times, .. Birthday Boy, happy birthday. Once Upon a Time in America, the European cut. Lata Singh says, and these are all in hashtag form, I really should have broken them up. Gare Berry, Son of Saul, Inland Empire, Men Without Wings, The Hireling, Ni Changahar, I am so sorry, Stalker, Sally, Omkara, Satya, and Barton Fink. Rodolfo Ciaro says, had to watch Inherent Vice twice just to understand why Wok was saying, gotta add the other guys to the list. Kyle Wade, Only God Forgives, and most Kubrick films. Tony Hines, anything from the Coens, most notably Big Lebowski. Also, Blade Runner with its many different cuts, which is, again, something we did not get into. Chris Ortman, I have two films, Miller's Crossing and The Life and Death of Colonel Blimp. Depth and nuance there makes it a necessity. All right, second Rock and Robin. Here we go. Whew. Okay. Muhammad Asif, The Wind Rises, Jake Sturdivant, Primer and Mulholland Drive, Myth Addict, which again is a great name. I doubt anyone who caught last year at Marion Bad fully appreciated it the first time around. Takes at least three viewings. Mark my words, Mulholland Drive, Sebastian Padone. I don't know the type. Sometimes you feel like there's more there and you couldn't see it the first time. Brendan Kennedy, Synecdoche, New York again. I've seen it twice and I'm still baffled by it. Ryan Green Skittles, which cannot be his real name. I feel like I could name a hundreds, but I'll go with my favorite movie ever, Brick. Ben Popick, this is a better question than last time, so I'll answer it for real. This is the man who said that his favorite remake was The Karate Kid with J-Dog. Enemy, Primer. I also just rewatched the Christmas episode of Black Mirror and the first bar, the dating coach session. Definitely gains a layer upon a second viewing. And then Nick Russo rounds us out by saying, again, Inherent Vice. So, I think that there was a definite theme going on there, and it's all movies that we spoke about.
Well, the one thing, I didn't want to get into it, guys, but the one thing that is a corollary to what Dan was saying about Memento is, you know, mystery box movies. You know, we could have obviously talked about J.J. Abrams stuff.
Oh, let's not.
Well, I listened to a really interesting podcast that was talking about TV twists, but it ended up turning into movie twists as well. And they had one of the guys, I can't remember his name for the life of me right now. He's on the Vulture TV, Matt Zoller Sites, I believe. And he hates twists. And so he was just lamenting the fact that if you have to watch a movie or a TV show or something like that where there's a big twist in the middle of it, and that's supposed to recontextualize everything you've seen before and everything you've seen after, and you watch it a second time, he said, usually it just does not hold up.
Right. It's like a surprise instead of an actual good piece of art.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. Well, I don't have a title for this next topic. I do know that it was bred by Dan Mecca, who on our Slack, which again, we are not sponsored by Slack, but we should be.
Hashtag Slack sponsorship.
Sponsor us, Slack. In the middle of listening to our podcast on Magnificent Seven, was slacking at us and said, please tell me you guys at some point talk about diversity in this film, because he hadn't gotten to that point yet. And then when we did, he said that he disagreed with us and couldn't believe we didn't bring up something, only to find out that upon actually listening to the whole episode, we did talk about it.
For 10 seconds and in the most like throwaway, who gives a shit about this moment way possible.
Well, because
but yes,
he
more than
gives
the last
a shit
shot
about this movie podcast.
Okay, go ahead.
Anyway, continue. So Dan Mecca, you wanted to talk about, I believe, diversity?
Well, no, I mean, so honestly, this is almost,
first,
I mean,
it seemed like you just wanted to do Magnificent
Seven,
but then you brought up diversity.
We'll keep this pretty short. I mean, this is almost, you know, you can call this a half topic response.
Yes,
I can't wait.
No.
So I have a song queued up. I mean, I had a song queued up assuming that this was about diversity. So can I? I'm just gonna
do whatever
gonna
you want to do. Yeah,
that.
You. Right, yeah,
so
you
here,
the song.
Here it is.
Go ahead, bud. I love this.
That is, of course, Michael Jackson's Black or White. All right, Dan Mecca, why don't you jump on in?
Well, no, so just...
What the
for
hell
some,
are we talking about here?
For some... No. Okay, so for some context, okay, I just watched The Debate, which for all watching in the far future, 2016, September, presidential debate, Hillary Clinton, Donald Trump. And I
Who
was...
Who are they?
Exactly. I was laying in my bed listening to this podcast. Now, look, I will say, so Magnificent Seven, the remake, I'm not even coming into this as a huge fan. I mean, I enjoyed myself at the movies with this film and kind of immediately lamented when I started listening to the podcast that all three of you seem to not like it. And I'll admit, look, I'll also admit this on the outset. I work in production for my life, right? For my day job. I'm a producer in New York City. So I've been on a lot of sets. And with every passing year, it gets harder and harder for me to kind of listen to or read general criticism that turns somewhat mean, even if it's a bad film, because I know how much work goes into each and every shitty commercial you see, shitty movie you see, good movie you see, what have you. Okay, so those things are on the table. Now, I just think, now I know you guys kind of talked about this a little bit, I feel like, in the Ghostbusters of it all, right, about this thing of we're in 2016 where people are reappropriating things and there's this cultural, if we recast to appease a certain demographic, a certain progressive notion, maybe that'll make us a buck, right? So that's a cynical way of looking at it, right? But obviously, I know Brian, you tend to feel that way if the movie doesn't work, right? So Ghostbusters, you know,
oh no, I believe that was a good faith effort. I don't think that was a cash grab.
Okay, right, but the general thinking being, if it's not working, right, or I guess just jumping to Magnificent Seven, right?
Well, I mean, if
your contention.
What do you mean by not working? Like the movie?
Yes, the movie not working. So basically what I gathered from specifically your review of Magnificent Seven is that it almost felt more offensive that the movie just tacked on an Asian, you know, an Asian character, a Native American character, a Mexican character, and didn't do anything with them than if they had just stuck with the original seven white guys ride into a town to defend against robber barons as they did in 1960, right? That was basically your contention, right?
Yeah, pretty much.
Okay.
I mean, it's an update, and it's a good sign that companies, production studios are willing to do that. But yeah, without really...
Okay. Someone on Twitter
once said that if you're making a progressive argument and you don't like offend someone or get people mad at you, you're doing it wrong. And I feel like that was the most milquetoast way, oddly enough, to do diversity.
Right. So I guess one thing that bothered me listening to your podcast, the podcast from last week, was that there's just a bunch of things that I feel like didn't get noted from that film, which I, you know, marginally enjoyed, which is kind of funny that I'm coming into it with that kind of, you know, very middling opinion about my general enjoyment.
A second viewing might have made us appreciate the film.
I guess so. So just, I'm going to run down them. Okay. I'm going to run down these things. Okay. That I noticed when I watched the movie for the first and only time so far, which is okay. I'm just going to go down them right now. Vincent D'Onofrio. Okay. He's a mountain man who's made his name off of killing, you know, quote unquote Indians, Native Americans. Okay. He dies brutally at the hands of a Native American in the film. All right. Mm-hmm. That's one. Two. Byung-Hun Lee is Billy Rocks, an Asian man and surrogate brother, son figure of a Southern gentleman who then steps up and covers for that white man, that white friend, when he literally cannot shoot straight, right? Okay. Denzel is a black lawman, right, in post-Civil War, like you guys talked about, with a past built on oppression of minorities for capitalistic gains. And the scar alone, right, points to those motivations, and without kind of overtly, you know, bringing it into this whole world that they're coming from, I feel like the scar amongst kind of the other past, you know, sins that he notes and the crimes against him and his family, you know, that, and you guys did briefly discuss that. Okay. And then a villain, and this was also briefly discussed, who's kind of built on capitalism, represents capitalism in its kind of purest and most evil form to some degree, who kind of will solely expand his empire and revenue stream no matter what the cost and bloodshed. Now, I guess my point is this. Those are important things that are in the movie relatively directly, not to mention bulking up the female's role, right? I believe it is a female who kind of ropes them in the 1960 version as well. I might be speaking out of school on that one, but either way, they bulk up the role where, like you guys talked about, I guess negatively, you just feel differently about this negatively that she like didn't talk to the town. Like that was some bad thing where in fact, I like the assertiveness of
I said that was a good thing. Like good, I like that.
It's just kind of funny.
Right. So I guess my thing is all these moments are important in a movie like this that's going to make a lot of money and be seen by a lot of people. Okay, like there is a poetry, right? And it's, you know, it's not, like I said, this isn't, you know, an Oscar winner prestige picture. You know, it's basically a summer movie that was released in September. But I think all these things are important, like, and obviously intentional. And then one thing I brought up on Slack when we were talking about it is I don't think that it's a surprise or just some lucky thing that at the end of the film, you know, you have, spoiler alert, obviously, you have three living from the seven, and the two of the three that are living are the only two natives of North America, the Mexican and the Native American. That's a decision. I mean, that is a decision that is saying something about the 2016 of it all and also where that film is coming from. And I kind of appreciate that there's a movie that exists, you know, because you have Django Unchained, right? Which is, Brian, which is kind of what you were talking about, right? You have a movie, a good movie that lives and breathes and contextualizes the black man in a post-Civil War world and uses the N-word, which they would have used, right? And uses that blatant, brutal racism, which we all kind of believe and obviously is historically recorded, that was there. So you have that movie. And what I like is you have this movie. Sure. And you have this movie that, well, I'm not even talking about, I'm not trying to review Django. I'm just saying you have that movie and that is a good movie. And then you, but I like that you also have this film, which, yes, does it maybe play with the past in that it's like, the only time we hear about, you know, Denzel's, you know, the color of Denzel's skin is that first scene when people are whispering about him. But I think the important thing, and I know, you know, Bill and Michael kind of talked about this, is that, you know, the importance of that type of casting is that, well, we might think that, you know, it's simple or opportunistic to some degree. The Native American teenager watching it probably isn't thinking that, right? And so that's an important thing to acknowledge. And I above everything else, right, you know, aside from me being a huge Denzel homer and Ethan Hawke's one of my favorite actors and I just like westerns, aside from all that, right, that's what I appreciated the most about the film. And I just think it is an interesting topic, and you guys did kind of already touch on it, so I don't want to spend too much time, you know, on it, honestly, but it is an interesting thing as we move further into this world of, there's an Ocean's 11 remake called Ocean's 8 starring all females, right? There are a myriad of films coming out that are kind of doing this. And I like that, right? Like, I'm not saying I love everything being remade and reappropriated, but I like that there's an awareness of, hey, not all of us are white people that are, you know, 18 to 35. That, you know, that 18 to 35 demographic is just as important as ever, but
some
it includes
of us, like
women.
Michael, fall outside of that demographic.
Sure. It includes women. It includes, you know, any, you know, any and all races. And I think I just like that a movie like this can get made the way it's made. And it's almost that not that much of an issue, right? You know what I mean? It's like, sure, it came out. It's a hit. It's going to do well. It's not a bad movie, in my opinion.
Yeah. I never heard any of the backlash to this film that there was for Ghostbusters, right? Like, sure. Like, this film just happened, and it's just like, oh,
I was honestly surprised it came out, because I was like, that's a thing that's happening?
Yeah.
Yeah, and I mean, yeah, I just, you know, I just think it's, you know, like I said, it's really not a full topic, because it's been discussed here and there, sure, and everywhere, but, you know, I honestly felt compelled as I was listening to it. I was fiery after the debate, you know. I was,
well, that's your fault for watching that.
My most engaged self politically wise. And so, you know, I just felt like it was a good opportunity to kind of just talk about it. Cause I think, you know, Brian, your point definitely has a lot of merit. I mean, of course, it's like, you don't want to just get movies greenlit because, oh, can we get Kate Blanchett and Sandra Bullock to play,
but
you know,
see,
Brad Pitt, George.
Here's my,
you know,
problem with you bringing up like Ghostbusters or Oceans. Are they calling it Ocean's 11? Is it just
Ocean's
11?
It's just Ocean's 8.
Is it a prequel?
Yeah. No.
I guess it's Ocean's 8, so they don't have to get 11 people, right?
Yeah.
I don't know.
Well, I mean, you would think. I'm going to make this joke anyway. You'd think they could have even more than 11 because they're only paying those women 75% as much as they would pay men.
Oh.
topical humor. So what I'm going to say is, like, I don't have a problem with the Ghostbusters being remade as women.
No, I know you don't. That's not what I was saying.
But that's primarily because if it weren't for the historical context of the story they were telling in Magnificent Amberson's... no, that's not right. Magnificent Seven. Having a child eats your brain alive. It wouldn't have been a much of a problem for me. Like, if this were a remake of the Magnificent Seven now, or even like 10, 20 years ago, or in space in the future, I don't have a problem with it. Like, there's nothing there. I just feel like bring up good points about some things that maybe were
done on purpose. Well, but here's the thing, though. I hear what you're saying, but I guess this is my thing. You brought up Deadwood as a reference of, you know, contextually accurate. And look, Deadwood is an amazing show. I love that show. I'm excited for the movie if it ever gets made. But I guess this is my thing.
It's never getting made.
Yes, in those towns, right? In those you know, frontier towns, you know, the Chinese populace they were basically, you know, selling in the dark corners of that world, and were, you know, spit on and not respected. And I understand that contextually that needs to be shown if you want to make that version of that story. But the kid, it just brings me back to, like, we are four white guys talking about that.
Sure.
Okay.
Oh, yeah.
So the person who's watching that, who is actually Asian American or Asian wherever, that hurts potentially as much as if the movie was set in 2015, right? Whatever. So I like... Okay, and, you know, context or truth be damned, because it's the fucking Magnificent Seven, right?
Exactly.
Sure.
Exactly.
That you can do it, and it's fun, because Billy – and also, you guys were hating again, on, like, the Billy Rocks character, and he's the best character in the movie, which made me laugh.
Did
you guys
hate on him?
Yes, you were like, you wasted Byung-Hun Lee in this movie, where he's the brightest spot in the film, which found so
crazy. That's not saying a ton.
Yeah, well, Dan, agree that he's the brightest spot in the movie, but he's still fucking wasted. Like,
not wasted, but anyway, whatever. Let's not talk about that, because I like
eating a rock and there's a chocolate chip in it. Like, that's a great chocolate chip, but
Dan, I don't have the same problem as Brian in terms of, I completely agree with you that it's really important for, you know, people who aren't us, as you were saying, like, you know, a 14-year-old Native American kid, when he sees Red Harvest, when he sees Red Harvest, that's absolutely important. But the whole movie, this is potentially a bad faith criticism on my part, but the whole movie felt so messy and sloppy to me, and I did not recognize the numerous instances of visual symbolism that you saw. Narrative details that, you know, have outside context that the movie therefore felt like a half measure to me, because it occasionally draws it's so weird, because there's not really concrete moments where it recognizes that racism exists, but it isn't the other direction entirely either. So there is, like, an unspoken political context, and it's not really, it does feel like it's trying to be about something, even if it's a,
well, you know what, the movie, you know what the movie, right, the movie, you know what the movie reminded me, honestly, of, is, I think the political overhang of the movie is the most apparent thing about it, and it reminded me of the movie Troy, right, from 2004.
Sure.
Right. Which is to say, I like that movie. I think, you know, it's a relatively underrated film. You know, and not unlike the Magnificent Seven was kind of received moderately well. People generally liked it. It did okay, but I feel like it's mostly forgotten. But the nice thing about that movie is they take out a lot of the mythos, right, of that, the Iliad and that story, and they replace it with a political bent, right? Like, Agamemnon isn't just a villain. He's a villain who has, you know, a jealousy of his brother and kind of a megalomaniac kind of a political ideal and all this stuff, right? And
also Brad Pitt's butt.
Rapids Butt. And also, like, butt. And they play with they play with Achilles, right? Because Achilles isn't necessary. I mean, him being half of a god or whatever, that's a rumor, right? It's like propaganda in the film, right? He's just a very good warrior. Right. I like all that. In this movie, what I like is you have the Peter Sarsgaard character who is just, you know, the cynicism therein of Magnificent Seven, I like. So a lot of people are critical of the fact that Denzel's character has a personal motivation. Okay, and I understand that because in Seven Samurai and the original, they're just good people helping good people. Okay, but what I like about Zell having this thing is that not America, right? Like, he does a good thing in favor of himself and also others. And I like the cynicism buried inside that good versus evil
I have to take issue with what you just said about
because
the ending of that movie is a god-awful ugly CGI shot of four fucking headstones and this woman wispily speaking to the ether. Oh, they came in and they did something that was completely selfless and it was magnificent.
Hey, I'm not saying the movie wasn't made by a studio trying to make $100 million. That's not what I'm saying. I know that's what happened at the end of the movie. What I'm saying is, not unlike, you know, and this is a lofty comparison and I'm not comparing these two movies, okay? But Douglas Sirk movies in the 50s ended the same fucking way, okay? But when you watch those movies a second time, to bring it back to the topics,
bring it back around.
The stuff that he roped in there about sexuality and about Americanism and about having to bury things deep inside because it wasn't socially, you know, socially acceptable, right? In a movie like All That Heaven Allows or whatnot, okay? When those movies came out, they were considered fluffy and melodramatic and okay, right? Everybody liked Rock Hudson. They thought he was pretty, right? Now when you watch them in the social context of culture, of time that's passed, you appreciate them more because you realize what Douglas Sirk was doing, what he was injecting into those films. And I don't think Antoine Fuqua is a particularly accomplished filmmaker. I don't think he's very good, right? I don't think that. But I don't think you can deny that those things in this movie are important to just be aware of. And you're right, like, that ending is ridiculous, the magnificent line at the end. Yes, I would never disagree with that. But I also don't think that ending does it betray the other stuff? Sure, you can say that, but I don't think it negates the other stuff that are so important for people that aren't us, you know, and us, but more importantly, other people that aren't us.
I think
one thing that hasn't been mentioned in this discussion, this kind of topic that I think is kind of obvious, and I think we didn't do enough to talk about it during the podcast either, is that unfortunately, because every single time we mentioned the character, Brian just couldn't help but mention not Jennifer Lawrence.
Haley Bennett.
And I really like her character in this film, and it is one of those rare female characters that really actually doesn't need help from anybody. And the whole time she's very self-reliant. And
except
I mean,
she's
definitely the one that is going out, getting these people together. And, you know, I think I mentioned it a little bit, but I mean, she's also a gunslinger in the truest sense. And you guys
had fun with the scene where Chris Pratt tries to help her, but that's a great scene because it totally goes the other way where he's trying to be like a dick and flirt, and she's basically like, no, I'm good. Do you know what I mean? It's like, I think some of that got lost.
It still feels cynical, and I think part of that is
that feels like a reshoot. Honestly,
why
do you care if it's a reshoot?
Because it doesn't feel cohesive in the film, and I'm noticing it.
Yeah, because intention matters, as I'm so fond of saying. Now, my final point.
Can I follow through real quick?
Yeah, go for it.
Okay.
Part
of the reason that I feel like that sequence doesn't work is because of I had already been put on high alert because of that sequence that I mentioned. And I never heard you mention how you reacted to it, Dan, when they first meet the Mexican and they kind of jokey, maybe sort of insinuate raping her.
Yeah, I mean, that's a bad call. I hated that part.
Okay, Okay. Okay. I just wanted to make sure that that wasn't me reading that wrong.
No, and I agreed with you guys. I mean, I agreed with you guys. When you recorded the podcast, that and then he becomes kind of the most likable character. It's a strange decision. I don't know why that happened. I mean, it's certainly very. I mean, when I was watching the movie, I was like,
"Rapist, right?" I mean,
yeah, it's weird. I understood the setup because he's meant to be a criminal, right? I understood that.
Yeah,
I felt like their thought was he's always threatening to fight Chris Pratt, and then they become friends at the end, but that wasn't quite enough.
I want to make a point about this that I think has been lost. It's not just the historical context of this movie. It's the tone. When you have things like this guy threatening to rape this woman, or when you have things like just the sheer brutality of it. Like,
where we don't know who's the hero.
This is a movie that strives for something approaching like gritty realism in its Western, while at the same time indulging in fantastical gunfights and stuff. But it really does feel like it's trying to... I mean, it's from the director of Training Day, as every poster says.
No, but don't say that and have that be. I don't like phrases like that. Okay, because what you're saying is.
Isn't
I know, but just don't say from the director of Training Day like he can't make a movie that's not Training Day. Do you know what I mean? Like, saying that aggravates me because that guy made. Fair. 9 other fucking movies. Okay, he made King Arthur, right? He made a bunch of other movies.
Oh shit!
Tears of the
King
Sun,
Arthur?
The Place of the Killers.
All I'm saying is,
I know he made Training Day, but he made 9 other films. Okay, and I think.
Right, but I mean, I guess King Arthur is another good analog because, like, that's taking like a fairy tale and grittying it up, and I feel like this movie too takes a fairy tale and gritties it up. But then maintains some of the more whimsical or hopeful elements, and it adds to the mess that the movie becomes. And like, I would say that let's see if anyone remembers this movie. If this movie had had more of the tone of something like The Warrior's Way, then I would not have even bothered bringing that up because it wouldn't have even crossed my mind. Does anyone know what I'm talking about when I say The Warrior's Way, by the way?
No, I've never seen it. Okay, I mean, I know the movie you're talking to, the Kate Bosworth.
Yeah,
I know
Kate
that.
Bosworth. I know. And right.
Jeffrey Rush.
Yeah,
Jeffrey Rush.
But
so
that's a Western that has a very mixed cast, and it has almost the same plot, really. And you know, it's a town coming together, a bunch of misfits, and they have to fend off a greater evil. And I just feel like that movie modulated all that stuff to the point where, like, I didn't question anything. And this movie, The Magnificent Seven, through its tone and through its violence and through everything else, it seemed like...
Its inconsistent character beats was the major thing for me.
Yeah.
I had trouble making those connections.
When a movie is that flawed, it is hard to believe that the... good things that you are seeing in it were done purposefully and with great forethought, and it feels
I gotta tell you though, that general opinion is I don't know that many movies are made that don't have a lot of thought in them, even the worst ones. I mean truly I really think there's a limitation to that general opinion that, I mean, you know, you can say it's messy and I wouldn't disagree with you because it certainly is, right? I mean, I freely admit that, okay? But I mean, to say that people didn't make decisions and think about those decisions and have discussions, I mean, I just don't think that's correct. I mean, I just don't think that's correct at all. You know, I mean, of course, that a lot of thought went into this film, no matter how bad you think the film was, right? Just like a lot of thought went into Listen Up, Philip, and Interstellar, and you know, just name any movie. I don't know. I just think it's like that's. And that also brings it to the thing of when you talk about the guns, it was surprisingly violent, no question about it. But I also think it makes kind of a point about that. Like, there's a couple lines, you know, one of them is in the trailer, for God's sakes, the Denzel line where he's like, if one has a gun, you know, he tends to use it or whatever that line is.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
You know, and then when the Gatling gun comes out, they make a point of, like, saying to you visually through the sound editing that this gun, right, this new of the time, this new weapon is vicious, more vicious than anything that any of these guys have. So I think it makes a point, or tries to, of the escalation of weaponry, of violence, of death when you have these things. So I don't know. I mean, I saw things in it that I feel like, you know, obviously the three of you guys didn't see, and that's obviously totally fine. But you know, I just felt like it was kind of an interesting thing just to kind of dig a little deeper into, even just on a macro level, you know, when it comes to these things. And it kind of ties back into that first topic, the more we talk about it.
Sure. It's helped me give more appreciation of the film. But yeah, I think you're right, Mecca. It's easy for us when we're not involved in production and we're not seeing it from think of it in that kind of context. And I think, you know, you're saying that a lot of these things were thought through and discussed and hampered over. And yeah, I can probably guarantee you that a lot of this stuff, the studio probably pushed back against certain things, and Fuqua probably was like, no.
Yeah, and it feels like, you know? I mean, your guys' points about that are right. It feels like a movie that got messed with by the studio, like, you know, no question about it. So, you know,
I don't believe I ever said that at all.
Okay.
Yeah.
I literally talked
about why did the studio let this movie be this long?
Right. No, but when you're talking about reshoots, Brian, that means that the studio would come in and say that you need to reshoot that.
Oh, I don't know if that was the studio or if that was them on the set. But yeah.
Okay. Sure. I don't want to get into a semantic argument.
Dan, I'm curious. Do you have any thoughts about the length, Dan?
Yeah, it's too long. I mean, I don't really like the movie that much. You know, I like a lot of parts about it, but generally.
He didn't mean in a quality sense. That? He meant.
No, because you liked it more. I mean, I just wanted to hear
a different
point of view about it.
Yeah, I mean, it's the length. I think there are parts in the middle that are just like a bit too. I mean, you guys mentioned, and I have to agree, the banter scenes have a weird length to them that feel somewhat almost uncut or something like that. There were some moments where they're kind of joking around where the jokes aren't funny enough, and the cuts to the comedy aren't quick enough. And I think, I don't know who mentioned that, Michael might have mentioned that, but you know, that all rings a little false. But I mean, you know, generally I did enjoy the movie as a whole. But honestly, any movie that's more than 100 minutes, and I think, I don't know who said this, I think Brian.
That was me.
It was Bill. He said it has to be great.
Right. But Bill, you kept saying this movie is 2.5 hours long, where it's like 2:10 at the most. You were like,
well, I
might have felt that long.
I read it was 2.5 hours. Now that may be with credits.
It's 2 hours 13 minutes.
Yeah, whatever. It just was funny.
When you factor in trailers and stuff, that's a long time to be in a movie theater for a bad movie.
No question about it.
To be honest, that's where most of my frustration was last week. If this was a much shorter movie, I think I'd be giving it a lot more slack.
Yeah, no, and it should have been shorter. Every movie should be shorter.
Okay. Well, glad that we were able to get a dissenting voice on. I'm always happy to. I wanted to say entertain that, but that sounded super condescending. And unlike most times when I sound super condescending, it's not what I meant to do.
And yet you said it anyway.
Yeah.
You're like Trump. You're like Trump at the end of the day. You're like Trump. You're like, I didn't want to say it, but I said it anyway.
This is mean. I shouldn't even say this, but I'm gonna say it anyway. I'm glad that we had a chance to talk about this, because when I was cutting that episode, I said I could take out pretty much everything but this diversity discussion, and we wouldn't lose any like real meat in this. It would just be a lot less of us shitting on this terrible movie. So I'm glad we were able to flesh that conversation out even more. And I looked it up. The Warrior's Way is on Amazon Prime for free. So I'm 100% serious. This is a great, great fucking movie, and everyone should watch it. That is all.
That just said by the one person who ever saw Warrior's Way, Brian J.
I don't deny that movie. That movie came out, like, people gawked over the trailer for 2 days, and then, like, nothing happened. But
fun fact, Brian works for Relativity, the company that made Warrior's Way. No, I'm just kidding.
I thought that I was on A24's payroll, honestly. That and Slack. The creative team messaging service.
Slack, we're at 11:40. Everybody was like, what is Dan talking about?
Yeah, I was laying in bed after having finally got my daughter to go to sleep, and I'm like, what is happening?
So my wife now of 3 weeks, Kelly, was in bed, and I was like in bed typing like hard, you know, because I was all jacked up. And Kelly, she turns around and she's like, hey, can you just type softer? And I was like,
oh my god. All right, well, that's it for today. We went super over, but I'm not gonna cut out anything, because this has been a deeply engaging and fun discussion, and plus Dan was here, so we can forgive a supersized round table.
Dan Warrior's Way Mecca.
That's perfect. That's much better than DJ Mecca.
Sure.
I'm going to add an air horn after I say that. That's it for today. If you have anything to add to these conversations that we've had, don't hesitate to tweet us. It would have been super fun to put out, like, what do you feel about diversity in movies and Magnificent Seven on Twitter? Let's see if we could get some Trump's America people to yell at us. I'm glad we didn't do that. Anyway, let me remind everyone that we are brought to you by MUBI. That's MUBI. Go to MUBI.com. They have a great service where you can watch any of 30 curated, carefully selected films at a time. You have 30 days to watch each movie from the day it's introduced. And they are generally incredibly awesome. I'm actually probably going to, once I hang up, go watch something on MUBI. Unless my daughter decides to wake up. I just checked. She's still asleep. This is great. Oh, of course I say that and she starts crying. Anyway, it's a silent cry for now. That's all. MUBI.com/filmstage. Follow us on Twitter. That is @filmstageshow. Hold on.
Keep going. You're almost there.
We're almost finished.
Okay. Follow us on Twitter @FilmStageShow. Follow us on Facebook, The Film Stage Show. And I'm going to skip over all the other funny stuff I usually say, because there's a 3-month-old who might try to kill me. Let's tell the fine people at home where we can be found. Let's start with DJ Mecca.
You can find me on Twitter @DJ Mecca and The Film Stage.
Bill Graham.
You can find me not watching Magnificent Seven again on Twitter @CableBFG. You can also find me writing about movies on Filmstage and FreshFiction.tv.
All right, Michael Snydell.
You can find me rewatching things that I'm too stupid to understand on Twitter at Snydell. And you can find my writing at Filmstage, and I'll have a piece on American Honey at Roger Ebert this week.
Oh, nice. And you can find me tweeting about The Warrior's Way on Twitter @BrianJRowan. Find my writing at thefilmstage.com. And, yeah, that's about it. So, ladies and gentlemen, thank you so much again for joining us. It's always a pleasure. This weekend we'll be talking about Camera Person, so tune in for that. It should be a blast. Guys, pleasure as always. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you again.